Okay. Would you please say my name is Daniels?
My name is Daniel Sack.
And your date of birth, please?
April 5, 1940.
Maybe if you would just start out, tell me about your people and where you were raised.
Well, I was born in Oak Park, Illinois. Lived there until after we were married, went to school there, went to the Illinois Institute of Technology for a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering, went to University of Chicago for a master's in business, and we got married in 1963. We moved out of Oak Park in 1965. Went to LaGrange Park, which is also in Illinois, and stayed there until 1983. And we moved to Columbus, Nebraska, stayed there until 1986. And we were transferred, I was transferred to the Boston office of the consulting firm I was with. And we've been in New England ever since.
What sorts of employment were you involved in those various moves?
From 1963 to 1973, I was with the Commonwealth Edison Company. That's the electric utility that serves Chicago and probably the northern third of Illinois. It's now called something else, but I don't remember. I don't know what. Utilities lately have changed their names every 5 or 6 years, and they never sound like utilities anymore, to me anyway. And from 1973 to 1986, I was a consultant with R.W. Beck & Associates, both in the Columbus, Nebraska office and in the Boston office.
Electrical engineers?
Well, all kinds of engineering. But I was mainly in the regulatory arena and the finance arena. Rates and rate making, contracts, power supply contracts, that type of thing. Did a lot of testifying before Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the Federal Power Commission, state courts, federal courts, on regulatory matters.
Rate
related, contract related, power supply related. Did a lot of work for, once I came here, on the Boston Edison, our dispute with Boston Edison over the 1980 antitrust agreement settlement. I left R.W. Beck in 1986, did some consulting on my own because I wasn't enjoying the consulting field anymore. I was looking for something else to do. I did some consulting in Michigan and a few other places, a couple other states, Ohio. And then I found the job in Concord in 1988, and I started there and been there ever since.
Was the consulting field changing? What made you discouraged about this field you've been so active in?
The consulting field definitely changed. It used to be that you would work for a client and you never did everything exactly perfect, but the client was loyal to the consultant because you would work with them all year long and you would hold their hand and you would meet with them, and you wouldn't always charge for everything, and you would build the relationship, and that was important. Then, along about the early 1980s, things began to change. Relationships became less important, and dollars became more important. And we began to lose jobs that would maybe go for $50,000 to somebody who bid $49,500. And they would throw a relationship away for $400 or $500 or $1,000. And after a while, it was obvious that know, things had changed a lot in the industry. It wasn't the, there was no loyalty. It doesn't surprise me that that was about the same time frame as companies stopped having loyalty to employees. And employees stopped being loyal to companies because they never knew if they were going to be laid off, if they were going to be fired, changed jobs, downsized.
Was this in the field of electrical engineering or across the board, do you think?
In the companies?
Was it a sign of the times?
I think it was a sign of the times, yeah. When I went to Columbus, Nebraska, people would be moved there by the company for, you know, 12, 18 months, 2 years, and then they would be moved someplace else. We all remember how companies used to ship people around the country as they grew in their job. That became very expensive, but it's what companies did to develop people. And that changed, and they no longer did that as much, and they were no longer loyal to people. And people who stay with a company for 40 years, 30 years became a rarity. Now people would change jobs every 3, 4, 5 years and think nothing about it. And I think that affected, that's about the same time as the consulting business began to change. What caused that in the economy, I don't know. I suppose price squeeze, maybe competition from overseas. I'm sure it's not a simple answer.
Had you, how did you feel about coming to Concord? Did the place appeal to you? What attracted you about this position?
The position promised to let me have an opportunity to use all of the things I've been doing for the last 25 years. I had extensive experience with electric utilities. I had designed substations, transmission systems. I understood how utilities worked. I knew about rates and contracts and so forth. And I had the background. And in 1988, when I came here, the town was embedded in an antitrust case against Boston Edison, and I think there were also 5 or 6 wholesale rate case increases at the same time. And the town manager at that time...
It was an antitrust case,
price squeeze. Where the wholesale rate was higher to us than they were selling at retail to their own customers, which theoretically can't be, but that's what they were doing. So they were in an antitrust case, which we did in fact win, but it was later overturned by the First Circuit Court of Appeals, and we didn't make it to the Supreme Court, although we tried. Would have been about $40 million trouble damage suit for the town had we been able to prevail at the Supreme Court. But they wouldn't hear the case, so that was the end of it. So at that time, we had all of those cases going, and I guess I walked into Alan Edmonds' office when he was then the town manager. And he needed somebody that could handle all that kind of work. And I walked in and applied for the job. As I recall, it was a 4 or 5 line ad in the Boston Globe. One time, run by some consulting firm that was helping recruit. I think they only ran it one time, and it was the Sunday I picked up the Globe and read it. So I guess the job was intended to be mine. So that started out the career here. I thought it was a nice town. I didn't really know much about Concord at the time, but it was a good job, good people to work with.
And did you have a family by that time?
Oh, yes. That was 1988, yeah. I was 48 years old then, so yeah, our children were born in 1966 and 68, so they were, you know, 20, what, 22 and 20?
Out on their own.
Yeah. Well, the 22-year-old was at Perkins School, because he's disabled, so he was in a special school. Perkins School for the Blind in Watertown also has a program for the disabled. And he was there while we were waiting for the state to find housing for him. The 20-year-old was in and was out of high school and working. And then later, Danny, who is the 22-year-old, did in fact get housing in Watertown, where he lives still, in a group home.
Me too. So, with the age of your children, you never dealt particularly with the Concord school system or were part of the community in that way?
No, I never. We never had children in the school system here. They went through the Framingham schools, because we lived in Framingham for 25 years before we moved to Sudbury in 2001.
Well, so you were already in the area?
Yeah. I was transferred here from Nebraska in 1986. And so we were already here. That's not right. 1976.
76.
We were transferred here in 76, and I left R.W. Beck and Associates in 1986. So we were in New England since 1976. And we were in three different homes in Framingham.
Tell me more about, you said Concord was a nice town. Tell me more about, where did you decide to live in Concord, and what was the town like as compared with what it's like now, let's say?
We never lived in Concord.
You never lived in Concord.
We lived in Framingham, and then in 2001 we moved into an over 55 condo development in Sudbury, the first one in that town, and that's where we live now. We never lived in Concord. The housing prices were just more than we could afford. If you're here, I guess, you know, but we couldn't afford to buy a house here. So we didn't live here. But the town's nice, and that, you know, the people are nice, but people are nice lots of places. But it's a very active town. There's a lot of people that work in town government, committees, volunteers, do a lot of things. It's an active, vibrant community. There's a lot of people that are, you know, volunteering all the time to do various things.
Like what? What has caught your attention, these kinds of efforts?
One of the things I think is neat in Concord is this unwritten rule that nobody does any one particular committee job or selectman for more than 6 years, even though there's no legal prohibition on it. It's an accepted practice over the years that you don't serve more than 6 years in any one position. And I think that gives you a nice turnover, and it involves more people, and it gives new people an opportunity to participate, because there's always new people moving into town. There's always, you know, the older people who move out of town or leave for other reasons. And it gives new people an opportunity that they don't have to try to unseat a 22-year incumbent selectman, which is, you know, for the most part, next to impossible. This way, everybody leaves at the end of 6 years, and they're just leaving because they, you know, that's the way it is. And I think that gives you a nice turnover in town. And I don't know of any other town that of the people I've talked to or the other managers or light plants, you know, I don't know of any other town that has that process in place. So I think that allows a lot of people to become involved. And as new committees are set up, they don't always pick the same people all the time. The light board has a lot of turnover. You know, they also serve no more than 6 years, except in extenuating circumstances where recently we had some extensions for more than six so that we could level out the terms again. They were all expiring at the same time because people had left early and things kind of got out of the way we wanted them to be, so that you wouldn't lose out of the five members of the board. You don't want to lose three or four all at the same time. And so, and that doesn't happen very often, I don't suppose.
To, but to it, sort of stagger the...
Yeah, so you can stagger the terms. So we extended some of the terms 1 year so we could get back to a more staggered approach. And that's what the town manager did.
Tell me about the light plant itself. What condition was it in when you took it over?
Well, it had a good reputation, as it still does. People liked the light plant in town. They liked the rates being low. They liked the level of service, the reliability. Is much better now than it was in 1988. We had low rates, but when I walked into the office over what used to be over in Kai's Road at 135, which is where the water department is now, I walked into an office that was dark and dingy, had orange walls, had 8.5 by 11 inch pictures on the wall from the top half of calendars, had a carpet that had so many bumps in it that the tops of the bumps were treadbare from people walking over them. And because it had been glued down, then it had slipped over the years and it had, you know, what do you call that?
Bunched up,
wrinkled up, whatever. I mean, it was, to put it mildly, the pits. It was not a conducive place. The lighting was terrible. The plastic shades were all yellow. You know, it would make you think of, my goodness, what did I get myself into here? So then we set about starting to, you know, freshen up the place and remodel and buy some new carpet and so forth. And then there was some discussion on the table at that time about adding a second floor to that building. And it seemed to me that spending the kind of money they were talking about at that time wasn't the right approach, and maybe we should find a different location. And so we put that on hold, and I was naive enough to think that there must be some other place in this town where we could go and build. And after 2 or 3 years of looking for other sites, you know, I don't remember the exact date we made the deal with the state through the town manager and the selectmen. But I was a little surprised at how difficult it was to relocate the light plant to better offices. If we finally did move over to between Route 2 and Route 2A, west of the rotary, west of the gas station, where the land was swapped with the state. The state prison didn't own that piece of land. And then in early 1990s, the state wanted part of the landfill and Goose Pond over near Walden Pond and exchanged. The prison declared the land surplus. No other state agency wanted it, and so the town swapped its land for that piece of land, and we moved over there, built a new building.
And that what that year was
1998. No. That's all right. Not right. I don't remember. 10 years? Could be. Yeah, because the substation was 1994. So, in 1988, the electric supply to the town was on some low voltage lines coming down Route 2 and Route 2A and coming in on a Maynard. And the reliability of the lines was terrible. We would lose lines at the peak time of the year. We would always have to be shutting people off or rotating blackouts, things like that, in order to maintain the power supply because the lines were so unreliable from Boston Edison. It was nothing that the lines were bad, it's that the supply was bad. We had bought in 1980 all of the low voltage lines within the town boundaries, so we owned those. When I came here in 1988, we'd already done that, and we'd upgraded a lot of them, but not all of them. But Edison never did anything outside of town to upgrade its facilities. So we were in that antitrust case at the time, and part of that antitrust case was a Boston Edison engineer that had testified that there was plenty of capacity in the 115 kV lines out of Sudbury into Maynard that we could make a connection. That's significant because Edison had been telling us for 2 or 3 years there was no capacity in those lines and we had to come out of Lexington down Route 2A into a piece of property that we used to own over at the corner, at Crosby's Corner. Well, that would have been about $20 million back then. And we didn't want to do that. We wanted to come out of the Maynard station, which was only 1,500 feet from where we wanted to get a piece of land. And then when the engineer testified under oath that there was plenty of capacity, Edison suddenly changed their mind and decided that maybe we could connect over in Maynard and not have to run all the lines into Lexington. So that we started to plan for building a 115,000-volt step-down substation at Forest Ridge, where we bought the piece of land and we put a substation there and fed it underground transmission lines out of the Maynard station, which is over in the corner where the four towns come together, just over by the Esco property. You have Sudbury, Maynard, Acton, and Concord all come together at one corner. And that's where Edison has a substation. And so we supplied out of that station underground into our station, and then rebuilt the whole distribution system. About $11 million job to provide more reliable power. And once that was done, we haven't had the kind of outages we used to have on the low voltage system. People in Concord Center no longer complain about dips in voltage and fluctuations and computers that suddenly shut off because the voltage dip's too low, which really irritates people who didn't just save the document. In the course of that, we put in all of the underground on Main Street and Harrington Avenue, Old Marlboro, over to the substation at Main and Ornack. Did all of that work, did all that cable work ourselves, hired a contractor to put in the conduit. And then we cut ourselves off from the low voltage supply and we just take power now at high voltage, which has given us a much more reliable system.
one time the low voltage system had been adequate. I guess I'm wondering, as all this was going on, what was happening to growth generally in Concord? And was part of your planning requirement to somehow predict and keep pace with that the other growth that was going on?
Well, certainly that's part of our job, is to know and be prepared for whatever growth happens in the future, and we're always trying to make projections for where that's going to be. And yes, you're right, at one point the low voltage system was adequate for the load of the town at the time. And then when the load got a little bigger than the five lines from the east could handle, two more lines were added from the west, from Maynard. But then we reached a point where, at some point you need more capacity than those seven lines can handle. And there weren't going to be adequate way of continuing to build low voltage lines, one after another, as the load would grow from 32,000 kilowatts to 40 or 45,000 kilowatts, where it is today. You can't continue to add low voltage lines. At some point, it becomes uneconomical. And they were old lines. Edison wasn't upgrading them, so the reliability was terrible. So that's when we decided we needed to get to a higher voltage. Back in the 1970s, 1960s, before we moved out of Kai's Road, I went through a lot of old files. At one point, they were up in the upper floor of the 141 Kai's Road building, where we had a storeroom. And I found a lot of letters from previous superintendents who told customers not to come to town because we didn't have any power supply. Because the lines couldn't handle any more load in that part of town, so it's best that you find someplace else to build. Now, in my way of thinking, that was wrong, that any utility, whether it be a town-owned utility or an investor-owned utility, has an obligation to serve whatever load wants to come to town. Eventually, that load came to town anyway. So chasing them away in 1970 didn't do anything real. Eventually, they came. And you have to build the lines, you have to build the substations. You really can't tell people, or shouldn't tell people, you don't come to town because we can't supply you. That, to me, was evidence of just a reluctance to spend money to maintain the system. And the physical system in 1980 was very poor. By 1988, it had been upgraded a lot. When I came here, they were working on upgrading it. The previous superintendents didn't put any money into the system. And while that helps to keep rates low, it also creates service problems, reliability problems, voltage problems, and all kinds of things that people don't really like. But that seemed to be the attitude back in the 60s and 70s. It's not the attitude now. I don't think it should ever have been the attitude. It'd be like saying, well, we don't want to build a road, so don't build your subdivision, because we don't want to build a road out there. We don't want to pave the road. And that's just not what towns should do. That's not their job, I don't think. But so utility should provide the service that is requested. So the system's much better shape now. We put money into the system, we maintain the reliability. And we don't have very many outages, except when storms come about and trees come down. But we don't have a lot of outages.
Sounds like a whole new infrastructure.
No, it's just about a whole new infrastructure, yeah. We've rebuilt a lot of the system, put up a lot of wires that are stronger. In some cases, the trees can lean against the wires, and the wires will hold up the tree rather than the tree taking down the poles, which means that we can go out and take the tree off the wires without interrupting service, or you may just get a little bit of a flicker, but you won't get an outage short of a major storm coming in, which obviously nobody can do much about. In 1986, the town passed an underground bylaw that required all overhead utilities to be placed underground at some point in time, not specified in the bylaw. And we started doing that in 1989 or so. I've been working on it ever since. So at the current time, we have about 45% of the town underground. It's a combination of taking down some of the existing wires and coupled with a requirement that you can't put up any new overhead subdivisions. Any new subdivisions, any new housing developments all have to be put underground. Even though they might be fed from the overhead on the road, we don't allow them to be put up overhead in the subdivision itself. And that means that all new subdivisions and so forth are already underground, so we don't have to come in later and convert them.
What does it mean to run lines underground? What is it? What accommodations do you have to make? What's different about underground transportation? Why aren't we doing that everywhere?
The real reason is cost. It's much more expensive to build underground than overhead. It is somewhat harder to find a problem because you can't drive down the street and look for it. You can't see the underground, so you have to use different techniques to find a problem area. But mainly it's cost. It's probably 10 times as expensive to go underground as to go overhead. But the town voted they wanted to do that, and then we instituted a 2% surcharge on the bills to generate the money to do it, and that's what we've been using ever since. There's a big underground project going on in the area next to the library and around Emerson Field, and that's being financed out of the underground money. It's about a $2 million project, and we're paying for that out of the underground funds that we've accrued over the years.
The 2%?
Yeah, the 2% surcharge. So that takes the electric wires down, but the big problem is that we can't get the cooperation of Verizon and Comcast to also take their wires down. Comcast has been cooperative more so than Verizon. Verizon only wants to take the wires down when they have the money that they also collect the 2% surcharge. So when they have money to spend, then they want to spend it. In some cases, we've had to encourage them strongly, you might say, to actually spend the money they have collected. They don't really want to do it. And the amount of money that they collect every year continues to go down as the telephone services get transferred over to Comcast or to wireless cell phones. Then the wired lines go down. The revenue generated by the wires goes down, so the 2% surcharge goes down. So there are a lot of areas in town where we still have overhead poles, like on Harrington Avenue, and the only people on the pole is Verizon. Everybody else, Comcast and the light plant are underground. The fire alarm is out of service and replaced by a radio system. So we have Verizon on the poles, so we can't take the poles down. Just this year, we finally, after 14 years, Verizon actually put wires in the underground conduit on West Main Street from the town line into about where the bridge over the river is. And those pipes have been there since 1994 when we put them in, when we did the substation. And we finally, this year, got them to actually use them. So that's the biggest problem we have, is we can get the things, we can get the, our wires underground, but getting the other occupants on the poles underground is a big problem.
What kind of leverage do you have in a situation like that? Have you been, did the courts play a part in this?
We have very little leverage. We'd have to take Verizon to court to enforce the bylaws or to enforce the statutes, and so far, you know, the town hasn't chosen to do that. That would have to be something that's initiated by the Board of Selectmen. But we don't have a lot of leverage over Verizon to do it. Just like we don't have a lot of leverage to get rid of the double poles that are in town. Where you see two poles in the same location, or we set a new pole, or someone will set a new pole because the old one maybe is not tall enough or is rotted. And usually the electric company will come in and make the transfer of the wires to the new pole, and Comcast and Verizon won't come and make their transfer. And so they just lash the old pole to the new one and leave it there for years. And so you now have two poles where it should be one, and their wires are attached to the old pole, which is strapped to the new pole. And that's, you know, it really looks ugly. It's not the right way to do it. But it costs them money to make the transfer, and they get no extra revenue for doing it. And while the law says they have 6 months, or 3 months, I forget which, to make the transfer, there's no teeth in the statute. There's no penalty if you don't. So while the law says you have, I believe it's actually 3 months to do it once the pole is there, there's no way to make them do it. And so without any teeth behind the law may as well not be on the books.
What's going on with the town government in that case? Is it that they want to try to be good neighbors, or they would rather not coerce, or they think in time it might happen? Or?
Well, we do a lot of coercing, and the town government does a lot of coercing and of Verizon, but they just don't yield very easily. And obviously it would be expensive to take them to court. Perhaps we should. I don't know. We haven't really ever discussed that with town government.
Why do you suppose the town government ruled in the first place to try to get the lines underground? And what were some of the discussions that led up to that?
Well, the discussions were before I got here. But as I read the history a little bit, it was mainly aesthetics. People didn't like the proliferation of more and more and more overhead wires to make everything look so ugly. And while that predated, to a large extent, the additional telecommunication services that we were getting out of cable television, and then you have other telephone companies, and you have other TV companies coming in and putting up their wires, then you have private companies coming in and putting up their wires. It just gets to be more and more ugly every year that goes by. And I think the town just wanted to beautify the community. And they wanted it to look nicer in the aesthetics. I think that was the main idea. At the very beginning, you see the original bylaw that was filed at a town meeting said that all the overhead wires in town had to come down in 2 years.
So it was aesthetical issues that were driving this move to get the wires underground?
I believe that was the driving force, yeah. The just wanted to clean up the looks of the town. And there's no question about it. If you look at some of the main streets in other towns, that you know, you have 5, 6, 7 different companies' wires up there, and Verizon will come in and they'll put up another wire, another cable, and maybe the existing cable is broken or become overloaded or become inadequate, but they never take anything down. They just put up a new one and add to it and bundle it a little tighter and just leave everything else there. And it just gets bigger and bigger and uglier and uglier. And even though I am a utility person at heart, overhead utilities in some cases can get really ugly. They just are.
Beyond looks or aesthetics, what are the environmental considerations of high tension lines going through? What effect does it have on human life or the quality of life?
I don't think it has any effect on the quality of life. There was some discussion back about 1989, 1990, 91, about the electromagnetic fields of the underground lines that we ran down Main Street. And people were upset that the EMF, or the electric magnetic fields, were going to harm people. But we took measurements that showed that by the time you got to the curbstone of Main Street, your field was reduced by 90% or 80% or some large number, whatever it was. And by the time you got to the front steps and into the house, there was almost no field coming from the cables in the Main Street. And once we showed the public those tests and those numbers, then they were more accepting of the project. That was this big substation project. Especially when you consider that you have electromagnetic field throughout your house because of the wiring in the walls. Now, electric magnetic field is generated by the current. And so the lower the voltage, the higher the current. So you have a lot of EMF field in your own home. But unlike the claims at the time, we're not all walking around with cancer and boils, and we haven't all lost our hair because of that, maybe for other reasons, but not because of that. But people didn't, that wasn't the popular opinion. So we had to prove it by the data. High voltage lines have more of an electric field from the voltage, but most people don't live very close to a 115,000 volt line, and those fields drop off rapidly also. So I don't think there is any significant health effect. The electromagnetic field, scare, the interest in the articles and the books that were all over the New York Times and various newspapers and publications has more or less just disappeared and gone by the wayside in the last, I think by the middle of the 1990s, 95, 96, it was pretty much gone.
What was at the root of that thinking? Had there been tests that suggested that there was adversity in being close to electromagnetic fields?
There had been some testing. I think it was out in the California area. I can sit up here if you want. I think it was out in California. There was some testing that seemed to suggest that there was a health effect, increased levels of cancer, but it was all subjective. It was not ever proven, to my knowledge. and we looked at some of the literature, and a lot of it was just suggestive. And so there was more of a overreaction to the possibility that there might be some health effects. I suppose it's not too dissimilar to the current discussions going on about the effects of cell phones on your ear and how much we use cell phones and what is that doing to our health from the magnetic fields and the electric fields from the cell phones. I haven't seen any studies that show that that actually is a concern. But then I also haven't been watching all the various sources, so I'm not really, you know, knowledgeable about that, but I haven't seen anything. I personally don't think that there's an effect there. Well, maybe that's because I don't walk around with a cell phone to my ear all day long like some people do, but it makes me wonder sometimes if the magnetic field out of the cell phone is any different than the magnetic field out of the home phone, because they work the same way, if that's any different. And we have used home phones against our ears for decades, and we're still here, we're still healthy, and I don't know if there's a significant difference between the two. I have never seen anybody make that comparison.
Well, you have beautifully described how the electronic infrastructure, electrical infrastructure of the town developed over the last 20 years. What about other aspects of the town's growth? Can you comment on how the landscape is changing, or the open spaces filling up, or wetlands being overrun, or I don't know. What's your overall judgment about growth in the town? It sounds like this aspect of what we're talking about, putting the wires underground, was a lot of thought went into that. Many other towns haven't done it. So that sounds like a real plus. What about other aspects of the town's growth over the past 20 years?
Well, you mentioned wetlands. I think Concord does a lot to protect its wetlands and protect its conservation land. They have, you know, put a lot of money into buying conservation land, to buying and maintaining open space, perhaps more so than a lot of towns have done. A lot of towns have open space, but aren't paying much attention to it right now. And then once a developer comes in, then suddenly they get all excited about maintaining this field that nobody has paid any attention to for the last 25 years. I think Concord has done that differently. They've been buying open space, and they have, you know, they have set up funds and dedicated tax dollars to doing that. I see a lot of teardowns of houses in Concord with bigger homes being put up. Perhaps homes sometimes called the McMansions, bigger than they should be on that size of a lot and that piece of land. I'm not sure that's good for this town or any other town if you end up with a lot of very large mansions that only a few people can afford to buy and maintain, as opposed to the smaller housing market that open up your housing stock to more of a potential buyer. But that's been a big change. There's a lot of teardowns. I haven't seen a lot of wetlands, you know, filled in or things like that. You do see now houses squeezed in where you would not have thought they would squeeze them in 10, 12, 15 years ago. Where they will take one house and it has a big backyard, like the one out on west of the light plant office, where they put some condos in the backyard, and where there used to be one house, there are now five or six housing units. And I think you'll see a lot of that coming, because the land in Concord is expensive. The best use of that land is residential, not commercial. It gives you the developers can get more profit out of building the residential than the others. So I think that's a change we've seen over the last 20 years. More houses being squeezed in where you wouldn't normally have thought they would have put something.
Surely the town government of a place like Concord, Massachusetts would have strong impulses toward historic preservation. How does this jive with the preservation directions in the town?
Well, a lot of the housing stock in town isn't necessarily historic. It's just old. You know, and it may only be 50, 60 years old. I mean, there was a lot of development in town after World War II in the 50s. That's the time I mentioned earlier when the 50s and 60s, the town utility, the light plant was telling people not to come. So a lot of the housing stock was built maybe 50 years ago. Well, in a town like Concord, it's not historic. It's only 50 years old. So I don't know that we're tearing down the historic parts or any houses that are in the historic areas. I'm sure there are people in town that think anything more than 25 years old is historic and should be preserved, but that's not what I see happening. I see those homes being demolished. There's probably a half a dozen homes right now that have been torn down and are being demolished, because we get the request to disconnect the electric. And usually the reason is stated on the order, you know, house to be demolished. And we know that that means it will be rebuilt with a bigger, fancier home than was there.
And more service needs.
Well, not necessarily just a bigger home doesn't mean necessarily that you sell more electricity. It doesn't necessarily mean you sell more water. If people live in a 2,000 square foot home, they have two bathrooms, or they live in a 6,000 square foot home with four bathrooms, there's still only two people living there, and there's still only a certain amount of water and electricity and other things that you can consume. So I don't know that necessarily building a large mansion, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 square feet, necessarily increases the utilities or the other service needs proportional. Probably doesn't fill that house up with children, so it doesn't drive the school system. There still may be the same number of children, they just have more rooms to live in than they used to.
What about other aspects of growth? The schools, the other services, the development of roads? And
I haven't seen any new roads being built. I think other than maybe roads in the subdivisions, I think the roads that are here have been here for a century. They get repaved, they get rebuilt, but I don't know that I've ever seen a new road being built outside of a subdivision road. The schools, obviously, we're building the third new elementary school in someplace between 5 and 10 years at a significant cost for the third one. And then I guess there's still a discussion about the high school and the middle schools, although I haven't seen anything lately on that. I think the school system seems to be in good shape as far as the buildings go. I don't know much about the educational system. So those are changes, but I haven't seen any new schools any expansion of the schools. Concord is kind of hemmed in. It has a certain amount of land. It can't really expand a lot, although that's what we keep telling ourselves. And then we have, big new developments like the Lexan over where the Esco property is over in the corner of town. We're going to put in 350 or 400 apartments. And that will bring in a certain number of students, but yet there's capacity in the elementary schools to absorb it in the third school. So I hear a lot of people say there's no place to develop in Concord anymore, and you turn around and you see the overhead door company close up over in West Concord and new condos along the railroad tracks in Concord Park or some. I think that's the name, Concord Park, where you have high-end condos being developed along the tracks where the door company used to be. So we closed up one commercial business, and we opened up maybe 70 or so condos and small storefronts over there. And that's what I see happening to lots of places in Concord. So there is growth, there is development, mostly residential.
And it sounds as though you keep being surprised at all the new ways people think of that they can crowd one more dwelling or one more.
Yes, it never ceases to amaze me how somebody can squeeze 3 or 4 or 5 units into what I thought was just a big backyard and, under the existing zoning and do it. It always amazes me when you drive by and you say, oh, what are they doing here? Well, this is going to be, 12 or 14 apartments, what used to be a single family home.
What is going on with zoning? Is that a progressive and creative function of the town government?
It is, and it's run, by the planning board, and I really am not at all familiar with the current status of the zoning or what's happening or what isn't happening or anything. I just don't stay up on that. Okay. I don't know.
Is there anything else you'd like to leave for the public record?
You asked before what other things we've done back, I guess it was in the early 1990s, we started to build a fiber optic network for the town, the light plant did. Originally so that we could run the utility billing that was at one location from multiple locations and we could exchange the information. So we began to build this network and then we expanded the network little by little until now we have about 30 miles of fiber optic network in town that provide a high-speed, reliable, dual-path network for all the town network and the town functions and the all of the servers and all of the telephone and all of the data and all of the internet access to all the town employees. So that's something that the town is getting. It really isn't the job of the light plant, but we wanted it for our own purposes, so we've now got a lot of fiber, and we're looking at expanding that amount of fiber to provide more services to the town in terms of load management and voltage control and monitoring and some metering of major circuits and maybe internet access, and maybe expanding that into even providing or building the infrastructure so that television and telephone and internet services can be provided by third parties so that it's not just Comcast that's in town. It appears that Verizon does not want to bring their fiber optic service called Fios into town because of the undergrounding. They don't want to spend the money to put it underground. They made that reasonably clear to us a couple of weeks ago when we met with them. So we're now looking at what will it take for us to do it and maybe open it up to a third party under bidding or let anybody else come in and provide the service. And my guess is that if we actually do that and take it to town meeting, then Verizon will suddenly have an interest in coming into town because they won't want to lose the business. But I may be surprised about that too. You know? They may just say, well, now that you've done it, we can't compete, and so we're just not going to come at all. So we'll see where that goes.
So that's a certain little lever that you that you might be applying.
Well, the competitive basis of it, I mean, we can build the network for less money than they can build the network. It would be nice if we would build it and they would come use it. Then they could get the service, we would build the network, and they wouldn't have to put out the money to build the network at their cost of money and paying income taxes on it, and we can build it for our own purposes and then let them use it. But I don't see that they have a lot of interest in doing that.
So by providing the service for the people in the community, does the town stand to have a steady income from it? I mean, will it eventually pay for itself, or has it already?
Well, you mean the network we have for the town? No, it doesn't pay for itself because we don't charge the town to use it. It's just a service that the light plant as part of the town builds and provides to the rest of the town at no cost. But if we build the network for and we use it for third parties to provide television or other services, then yes, it would, you know, they would have to pay give us revenue to use the system, and that would help pay for the system. So eventually it would pay for itself. But the way it is right now, it doesn't pay for itself because we don't charge to use it.
The town doesn't charge, or the light plant?
The light plant doesn't charge the town departments to use the network. And right now it's only used by the town. It's not used by anybody else. So we have the network, but it isn't available to the public. We are undertaking a trial in West Concord to see about providing some commercial internet services to some of the customers out there that have no way of getting Comcast or Verizon high-speed access to the internet. And if we can do that and do a trial to some of the homes out there, then that will help us decide what or if we should expand our efforts to the whole town.
Isn't it conceivable that it would generate income for the town eventually?
Oh, it would generate income if we built the system out and sold the services to third parties, yeah.
Or even to,
absolutely.
Even to the local public.
Well, that's what I mean by third parties. It's not the town. It's not the light plant. It's not the town government. It would be the customers, sure. It would generate revenue because, you know, obviously we have to pay for the system, and you're talking, you know, millions of dollars of infrastructure and fiber optic, maybe $4 to $6 million to put it up. Clearly, we would have to, you know, charge for the services, but they'd still be less expensive than Comcast or Verizon. So, I see that as a hope on the horizon that we can actually provide those services and make them as good and as reliable as the electric is. That's the goal.
Well, that little five-line ad in the Globe sure turned up the right color. That's,
yeah.
That's what it sounds like to me.
And I've had a lot of fun doing this job. It's a good job. I enjoy it. You don't get bored doing it, that's for sure.
But it's a job for beyond engineering. It's a job for a visionary, somebody who can look down the road.
Yeah,
20 years.
A lot of it is. It's not just putting out the day-to-day fires. Frankly, I don't even deal with those. I let the rest of the staff handle the day-to-day fires. I think my job has got to be above that and be more the visionary and the planner and the looking down the road as to where we can go and what do we have to do. Just like we're now finishing up a study with a consultant to tell us how we, what are the options of providing for the electric supply for the town through 2025. And we know that we have a peak load problem developing. We know we have some substation capacity potential problems coming. We know we have some transmission line capacity problems coming 10, 12 years from now. But we have to know now what should we do to be ready, because it could take us 3 or 4 years to do permitting and building and construction. And you can't wait until we need the power before we realize that we have to build something. So we're looking now as to what we can do to make sure that the town has adequate capability for the next 20 years. And that study will be finished sometime this fall, and then we can evaluate the work and decide what we want to do to begin to prepare. So that's what I see my job more as than putting out the day-to-day problems and fires.
How much longer do you have at the plant?
Right now, I've told the town manager I'm going to retire next July of 2009.
But that'll be after this plan has been finalized?
Yeah, it'll be after the plan's finalized. It might not be after any decisions have been made, but we will leave behind at least the scenarios, the plans, the ideas, the concepts. They won't be fully developed. One would then have to look at what are the options and decide which option you might want to develop in more detail. We won't have anything but rough costs. We won't have any detailed costs or any detailed environmental studies until you choose the options. Then you go into the more detailed analyses. So we'll leave that behind, and we'll leave behind, you know, a new operations center, a brand new substation, well, brand new relative to Concord's history anyway, and a very good electric system that will carry this town for the next half a century.
You're welcome. Your interview, and thank you for your good service over the years.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to talk to somebody who knows what they're doing in a world where nobody seems to know what's going on anymore.
Just don't ask me about Wall Street. I don't know.
you were telling me about a film crew that...
There was a film crew that came into town maybe 7, 8 years ago, and they were making a movie, and they were going to film some of the story on Main Street in Concord Center, and they were using a house, or a house front, I guess it really was, a shell that they had put up on Barrett's Mill Road. But they didn't like the streetlights that were in town in Concord Center because they're all high-pressure sodium. They wanted incandescent lighting, so the film crews came in and rewired all of the lights on Main Street and put incandescent bulbs in there for the film. And then when they got done, they put them back to where they were, except that they didn't do a very good job of putting them back, and it caused a lot of trouble for us to go back and restore the lights the way they should have been. So I don't think if another film crew comes in, I would want them to rewire all of our streetlights again, you know, because it was a lot of work to put it back the way they supposed to have been, because they didn't do a very good job. They just, you know, quickly put everything back and didn't worry too much about quality. So we had a lot of outages from the lights.
Yeah.